I'd also like to echo Jared and thank Ben very much for inviting me. I'm going to be talking about Rex Ingermell's Conditional Culture and an essay of A.D. Hope's called The Discursive Mode, just to set it up for people who might not know. I'm going to be talking about work by Rex Ingermells and A.D. Hope. Rex Ingermells, who was a radical nationalist who founded the movement the Jindy Warbacks in the 1930s, and A.D. Hope, who was, you know, is regarded as a great formalist, conservative, Anglophile, defender of tradition in Australian letters, and poet. And responding to Jared's paper. The importance of naming in Butler's poetics is interesting. There is the need for names for common objects. This suggests the poet needs to be concerned with the common, perhaps domestic, but also the communal, the nearby and numerous. Then there is his suggestion that, just as in frontier life, so in art, neither a beast nor an experience is tamed until it has an acceptable name, naming as taming. This is also the domestic, but in a different sense, as the subdued. Taming implies a violence or mastery. A tamed experience implies a certain power over the experience, which could take the form of knowledge. Or it could be that the experience is no longer dangerous. Naming is a basic settlement activity. What Paul Carter describes as the basis for transformation of an empty space in the mind of a settler or imperial agent into a place. In this sense, Carter is not so far from Wittgenstein, who suggests that activities like naming and pointing are the basic activities that allow for more meaningful discursive interactions. Wittgenstein says in Philosophical Investigations, naming is a preparation for describing, but also for play and exchange. Carter reads place names as acts by which a space was delineated as having a character, something that could be referred to. In the context of exploration and discovery narratives, Carter notes that Australian place names suggest difficulty. This is a quote from an interview with Carter. The names are extraordinary: Cape Catastrophe, Mount Dromedary, Lake Disappointment. These are names which have to do with not finding places. They allude to the inability of English to impose itself easily, and in that sense, they are telling us a lot about the history of the people arriving, and about the way they have to renegotiate language itself. I see a much more creative role for the naming process. It's not simply a blank landscape that's written over. It's something that has to be named in order to be brought into existence. But its very naming then reflects on the language which is used. The names work, but in the context of it, they make language very ironic. The landscape is brought into being as a place where language doesn't work. I like the suggestion here of a poetics of bad naming, names that don't work. But obviously, I think Butler is interested in naming that does work. I see naming as related to another concern of Butler's, that of accuracy and of the precision use of language's linking and likening tools. This kind of precision, which Butler also calls clarification, is a basic modernist trope, as in imagism. And what Butler calls the accurate employment of language to express a precise image or idea. No ornament. Accuracy is etymologically related to attention and to scientific correctness, but also to care. I want to compare Butler's poetics with those of the Jindy Warbacks, and to do this, I'll focus on Rex Ingermell's manifesto for the movement Conditional Culture, which was published as a pamphlet in 1938. Conditional culture is less articulate than Butler on craft, and I think Ingermell's is on the whole, though it does give some insight into Ingermell's poetry at the level of making and thinking. I want to look to it for its sense of material, both as the material of the poem and the material of the culture. Like Butler, Inga Mills emphasizes that the poet that has not come to terms with environmental materials has failed to articulate their true condition. At the heart of this position is the insistence on a set of strategies for coming to terms with the material, which is not a critique of how that material presents itself in advance of the poet, nor of the material of history exactly. In fact, a complete exclusion of the history of Indigenous dispossession is the basis for conditional culture, as we will see. The name of the movement was taken from James Devaney's book, The Vanished Tribes, which was a popular book of Indigenous myths and legends written by a white Australian published in 1929. And it's actually taken from the vocabulary in the back of the book. And interestingly, Devaney's sources for both his myths and his language haven't actually been recorded. And so they're not known in the scholarship what they are. Inga Mel's account of the term Jindiwarabak is thus. Jindiwarabak is an Aboriginal word meaning to annex, to join, and I propose to coin it for a particular use. The Jindiwarabaks, I say, are those individuals who are endeavouring to free Australian art from whatever alien influences trammel it, that is, to bring it into proper contact with its material. They are the few who seriously realise that an Australian culture depends on the fulfilment, sublimation of certain definite conditions, namely, one, a clear recognition of environmental values, two, the debunking of much nonsense, three, an understanding of Australia's history and traditions, primeval, colonial, and modern. Inga Mills dedicates large sections of the essay to debunking, which involves readings of poems and also of a long description of gum trees in the Mediterranean. The primacy of vocabulary in Inga Mell's thinking about poetry is evident from these debunkings, which dwell repeatedly on questions of the unsuitable exoticism of words. When Inga Mells uses the term idiom to talk about Jindiwarabak practice, it seems that it retains only its sense as a word choice or as a phrase. And though it is implied, there's little remainder of its sense as mode or form. And the following is an example of the kind of editorial suggestions Inga Mells makes, appended with commentary on the material. So a poem is cited. This poem would be perfect were it not for the two epithets elfin and goblin. The words cunning and reeking are the first substitutes that occur to me. The poet at the time of writing, with a little extra critical attention, might have thought of better. I may be thought to be quibbling here, to be running a theory to death. Poetry, it is said, is among the materials of poetry, but I maintain that a poetic idiom with a Hans Andersen flavour, while it may be suitable to Europe, is not suitable for an Australian outback scene. Integrity! Exclamation mark. Integrity! Exclamation mark. It is these kinds of choices between the import or the homegrown that are, I would arguably say, are the foundations of forms of literary nationalism, and that these are it's these choices that decide how open a writer is to what Inga Mells calls environmental values. Inga Mells suggests the following substitutions for lines by Adam Lindsay Gordon. So here's the Gordon. Hark, the bells of distant cattle waft across the range. Through the golden tufted wattle, music low and strange. Like the marriage peak of fairies comes the tinkling sound. And here's Inga Mell's commentary. It is all very well for Australian children to be told old world fairy tales, but our poets are creating false associations when they try to fit fairies of the Midsummer Night's Dream tradition into the mood of the bush. Pickaninnies and gumnut babies are at least more appropriate. So far, Inga Mells seems more interested in substitution than sublimation. There is a fetishizing of the name and the word in Inga Mells, which begins with the name of the movement itself and takes center stage in early experiments that use blended Indigenous English vocabulary. And actually, I don't have an example of this in the paper and I wasn't going to show it, but I think we have time, so I'll just pop it up. Mural Wathamiring, is that visible?
You'll be able to see it on the screen.
Oh, excuse me. I'll just leave that there. I'm not going to read it. But you can see the substitution that has taken place. Central to conditional culture is the claim that Indigenous culture is part of a national Australian culture. Ingemels believes that Indigenous people are a vanishing race, suggests no knowledge of dispossession, occupation, or colonial violence. He sees Indigenous culture as a primeval, mythic, and deeply conditional culture at risk and available for use. Thus, Indigenous words like Jindiwarabak are available for use as names, and these names function like souvenirs, as Susan Stewart describes them. Like the collection, the souvenir always displays the romance of contraband, for its scandal is its removal from its natural location. Yet it is only by means of its material relation to that location that it acquires value. And I would say that this is the same principle of valuation that is at work in vocabularies like the one in Devaney's The Vanished Tribes. Ingemels is drawn particularly to words and objects, and many of his examples of Indigenous culture are objects. For example, in another sense, Australian tradition goes back to the country of native legends, of the churunga, the boomerang, and the spear, of the bark gunya, and the nomad Aboriginal. Later in the essay, he writes, "When I see woomeras, spears, bull roarers, boomerangs, dilly bags, message sticks, churungas, and wax figures in the Aboriginal sections of our museums, and when I read scientific treatises and pioneer reminiscences dealing with Aboriginal occultism, funeral rites, initiation ceremonies, and so on, I am strongly conscious, often unhappily so, of much in our colonial tradition." The museum is an illuminating context for Ingemels' poetics. One might argue that the Jindiwarabaks themselves are a kind of museum piece movement in Australian poetry now, outdated and curious. I would suggest that the museum, as much as the vocabulary or pioneer reminiscence, is a presence in the poems. The first poem in Ingemels' first collection, Gumtops, is called Boomerang, and suggests the poet is examining an authentic, highly suggestive souvenir. This is the poem. "This piece of hardwood, cunningly shaped, was curved so evenly while Piccaninnies gaped at a warrior who chipped at it with pieces of flint and formed it by meticulous dint upon dint. Outside his wurley, he sat beside a tree and chipped at it patiently for hours, not for me, but to kill the wallaby in the rocky pass, to kill the fat wild turkey hiding in the grass." This poem is a catalogue of features of the context of the boomerang's production, but there is no mention of the process of exchange that led the object to the poet's attention. We might imagine Ingemels as a secondhand fetishist, fetishizing already mediated encounters, or as a writer of fan fiction who, despite having no real love of the production of their favorite television show, spends years writing trashy sequels to episodes and Slash and so on. Words themselves form the collection of the poem, wherein they perform the work of metaphors for the native. I want to turn now to another text, very different from Ingemels and Butler, which offers some interesting metaphors for poetic craft in the Australian context. A.D. Hope's essay, The Discursive Mode, subtitled Reflections on the Ecology of Poetry. I note the date of publication, 1956, and Hope's use of the term ecology in an extended context. Ecology is etymologically related to house, again suggesting the domestic, but Hope is concerned with ecology in the sense of a complex, interdependent environment. This is a quote. "Man is part of nature and human ecology is part of general ecology. The arts of man rise and flourish and decay as do the races and species of living things. They are rooted in the mind and heart, They depend on the climate of society in much the same way as plants and animals depend on the soil and seasons. Accordingly, proceeds Hope, disappearance of one species because of the failure of controls on its natural enemies may lead to disappearance of the predators as well. This takes place in poetry when the introduction of a new literary form, if it becomes popular, seriously upsets the whole traditional balance of literature. Hope sees literary ecology in the same terms as early systems ecologists, who regarded living ecologies as closed systems, which explained what they saw as their tendency to balance and equilibrium. However, this is beside the point for Hope, for whom the pressing issue is that of the diversity of literary ecology, as much as its balance. This is a quote again. Looking backwards, it is easy now to see the slow progress towards a desert ecology from the 16th century to the present day. It is still a young desert, like parts of the center of Australia, capable of responding to rain and good season or to irrigation, not yet a Sahara or a Gobi. It has its oases, but gone is the landscape in which the epic, the great philosophic poem, and the verse tragedy massed their great timbers and delighted by the contrast of forms and foliage, in which verse satire, the ode, the epistle, the elegy, the romance, the hortatory or instructive poem, the pastoral and the long meditative poem or celebrant hymn gave its general character to the woodland, while innumerable lowlier forms of sonnet or epigram and song filled all the space between. Instead now, there is only the sparse and monotonous vegetation of the arid steppes, little poems of reflection, brief comments, interior monologues, sharp critical barks and hisses, songs that never become articulate, earnestness that lacks the enchantment of truth, and frivolity that disgusts by its absence of charm. Hope attributes the superabundance of short, sugary lyrics to Poe and the symbolists, and is especially scornful of Poe's claim that a long poem is a flat contradiction in terms. Hope's suggestion is that a turn towards neglected forms, less associated with the highest pitches of expression and feeling, is the way to reverse this situation, advocating the middle form of poetry. That form in which the uses of poetry approach closest to the uses of prose and yet remain essentially poetry. It was a form which served without pretension the purposes of narration, the essay, the letter, conversation, mediation, argument, exposition, description, satire, or cheerful fun. Its mood, like the mode, was discursive, not intense or elevated or passionate. It was in this middle field that poets learned the exercise and management of their craft, and from this middle ground that poets moved to higher flights and moved with performance and skill. That was Hope. Hope's defense of craft is based in a defense of the tradition of English language poetry, and he takes a long view, citing Cowper and Chaucer as prime examples of his discursive mode. Ultimately, Hope advocates formal satire as the necessary corrective to lyric hyperabundance, suggesting that the first step in intelligent regeneration of the soil of poetry may well be to re-establish the discursive mode, but in particular to restore the practice of formal satire. For good satire not only spreads and encourages an appreciation of basic, simple forms of poetry, it not only nourishes and binds the soil, it is in itself a powerful force to check and eradicate the destructive forms. Satire culls lyric. Craft is a form of soil stabilization. Like peat, silt, or clay, the expressive and lyrical are no proper ground for the laying of a poetics of craft. Hope's essay anticipates the objections to him that are common in the 1970s. Hope's essay also anticipates the long verse satire, The Harrowing of Balmain, which was a response by Alan Gould and Kevin Hart, both students of Hope's at the Australian National University, to what they saw as the weedy bohemianism and affected newness of Sydney's new poetry movement. Hope's diversity of forms is based in the classical and deeply English, and it is deeply English in its sense of poetry's genealogy. Like much poetic rhetoric based around the notion of craft, it relies on a raw cooked distinction here between the formed made and the expressed felt. And also, which is a distinction between the long and the short. But Hope's insistence on both diversity and mode thinks the material as an expandable category, with forms of complex alliance and dependence between mode and articulation, aligned with settlement from the beginning in the sense of settled soil. Hope's sense of craft is that of a constant intervention on its literary ecology. I draw these two very different examples out of because of their insistence on the absent ground from which Australian poetry is constantly being articulated. And I think this is what Ben has called, in a paper of his, the problematic of the material, which is basic to questions of literary craft in post-colonial literatures, but it is also the supplement to Inga Mohl's radical nationalism and Hope's discursive program. In each, it is in the context of a lack of proper grounding that poetic making sets out. Butler's insistence on the image or symbol, Inga Mohl's insistence on the term, which is an appropriated metaphor in use, suggests the vocabulary as the basis of literary nationalism. Besides these, I might suggest that we might recover Hope's sense of the discursive as a basic practice in Australian poetry, one which includes the story, the letter, and the satire as key forms, though more various in their tradition than Hope's Anglophile formation. If each settler poetics concerned with a form of grounding, each is a settler poetics concerned with the form of grounding. Each bears a residue of symbolic violence. If material in a settler context is always an echo of the import or the trade, it is poetics that turns back upon this process rather than to the future that I want to promote. And curiously, this is the position that Hope's essay suggests. Thank you.